Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see underneath it all.
Yeah, that's right. And we are on episode number 54.
Oh, yeah.
And today we're going to talk about The Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
With a cast that is so talented, it's unbelievable.
You bet. It's funny, I watched the Oscars, well, maybe about the first half of the Oscars, for the first time in years and years and years. And the host, what was his name? Seth MacFarlane?
Right,
who I had no idea who he was. I had to tweet.
Tom had to keep reminding me.
Yeah, I had to tweet to somebody and say, who is this guy again? You know,
the
I honestly
Family
had
Guy,
no, yeah,
right?
I had no idea. I've never seen The Family Guy.
No, I've seen it parts of it once. That was enough.
Uh-huh. Okay. But anyway, I found out who he said, you know, there was a Coppola in the audience who was nominated for something. Wasn't an actor. I can't recall what he was nominated for.
Oh, yeah.
But he said that you know,
a writer maybe.
Yeah, so he was I can't even remember how many Coppolas had been nominated for Oscars, but he said, that must have been a tough house to grow up in. I'm having trouble, or I got an A on my math test, you know? And he's like, great, have you been nominated for an Oscar yet?
Yeah. What kind of story work have you done lately? How are you putting this together?
Oh, man. Yeah.
I know.
Tough house.
And plus, this movie was in 1972, mm-hmm. So we're watching, and I'm looking at these people going, okay, Marlon Brando, that's a given.
Yeah.
But we didn't look at who the cast was beforehand. And I kept saying, I swear, I'm pretty sure that's Diane Keaton. I'm pretty sure. And Tom kept going, no, I think you – maybe it's Mia Farrow. Maybe it's a different one of Woody Allen's ladies. And I'm like, And so we had to look her up because it didn't look like her, really.
Oh,
and
how about that?
Same
yeah.
with Al Pacino. And, you know, when he said, this lawyer is Robert Duvall, I was like, what? No.
Oh, heck
and,
yeah.
Yeah, they were just such babies.
They were.
You know?
Yeah, 1972, long time ago.
Yeah, they didn't have the mature faces that
yeah,
even
was,
just of a few years later.
When
you know?
I was 4 years old and I saw it for the first time. You know, it's funny. This is one of those movies that, you know, just
so
about everybody's seen. But this was the first time you'd ever watched it.
And my husband, too.
Oh,
I was
that's
really
surprising.
Surprised.
Yeah,
he
that is surprising.
It.
So
yes.
It was something that you avoided? Because you mentioned that you had read the book before.
Yes, and I had not. Well, of course, now let me think about this. 1972, I remember the movie was coming out. And I remember. This will tell you, because when I say the name of the class, I remember being in a home ec class and having a little free time and finishing the book up. And it was a very adult book. My mom didn't worry about, you know, my library censoring or anything. So 72, if I graduated in 75, so I was what, like a freshman or sophomore when I read The Godfather. And so, it was about then that I read it. And
well,
so the movie came out, and I was like, I really didn't care about the book that much. I really don't care about the movie. And watching this, I thought, wow, the violence must have been extreme for the time, because it was kind of extreme on my TV.
Yeah, it was. It was.
And, I'm never going to forget those feet
going
through the windshield,
kind of
okay? That's it.
Yeah, I got kind of history with that book, too. You know, I've got a long history with audiobook listening. And when I was in college, I had a job at Coca-Cola. And when I first started that job, what I would do is I would drive around to grocery stores from 4 to 9 at night and stock their grocery store shelves.
Oh.
So you can imagine how...
Oh,
you know, it
that's
was a, it
soul
was a,
killing.
It was a great job for audiobook listening. I used to listen to, but you know, there weren't a lot of audiobooks back then. This was the late 80s.
Right.
I graduated in 86. So I'm talking about 88 and 89 probably.
Oh, I feel so old now. Please, continue.
Oh, man. Anyway, I remember going to the Tucson Public Library. That's where I went to college in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
And they had a thing called a book cassette. Do you remember those audiobooks? Right. Did you ever listen to those?
Yeah.
So The Godfather was probably one of the first ones I listened to, one of the first unabridged audiobooks I ever listened to.
Ah.
And it had a cassette. You would put it in your player and you'd play it all the way through with your stereo on left. And then you would play it all the way through with your stereo on right.
Yeah,
and if
rewinding
you,
it, clever.
Yeah, so they got twice as much audio on a cassette.
So clever of them.
And then I, you know, said, well, I've got to be taking this in the stores with me. So I got a Walkman, you know, a Sony Walkman and all that stuff. And
I think it's interesting that far memory. Back in your book reading career, so to speak, essentially kind of almost as soon as they did it, you were adapting to new technology so you could listen to audiobooks.
I was. There's just something about audio that I just am totally attached to. You know, right now the Pope has resigned and all this stuff. My biggest memory of when John Paul II passed away was Father Roderick and that podcast. There's just something about audio. It's more immersive. I don't know if it's this way for everybody, but listening to his podcast, he called it, you know, a sound seeing tour or whatever. But that, just standing there describing what's going on at the Vatican and waiting, you know, on the next Pope to come out, and the Pope comes out and the Habemus Papam, you know, I remember that's all tied in for me with Father Roderick. Because there's just something about audio that's so much more personal to me. You know, I love audio drama. I love audiobooks, and anyway, I'm just an audio type guy.
But it's definitely personal. And the funny thing to me is I didn't used to be as orally oriented, I guess you would say, until I started listening to audiobooks. And I would have a hard time kind of remembering them sometimes, but my brain adapted somehow. And I can go back and forth the way, you know, you wrote a post about that I liked, that somehow reading and listening, it doesn't appeal to me. I might love it if I did it, but to go back and forth, depending on where I am, or if I have a really hard time with a book, and we've talked about this, like Dickens, the first time I read a Dickens book, really, or Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which I had a difficult time with after about 100 pages, but I started listening, and I was so caught up that I was sorry when it ended, and it's really long. 26 CDs, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's really long.
Yeah, I listened to Bleak House that way. So I had I had an audiobook version, and I had the book probably from the library or on my Kindle.
Right.
And then I would listen to the audiobook on high speed and read along with it.
Yeah.
And then when I was tired of that, I would slow the audiobook back down to regular and then go and do what I was doing. And it just allowed me to press through a long book in not a heck of a lot of time. You know, you get through it in quick time, but my comprehension went way up.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just a method that I've found recently. If I had had that in college, it would have helped a lot.
Well, and because I think I've said before that Rose would read out loud to herself because she just understood things better when she heard it.
Yeah, and then there's something about that too. Reading a textbook as opposed to watching a lecture or listening to a lecture, the lecture was almost always more... It worked better for me.
Memorable.
Yeah.
Well, and when you think about it, we're really keyed to listening. I mean, you know, there's nothing natural in the world about reading in terms of our evolution as animals or people or anything.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
We are storytelling people.
Yeah.
And you think about it, you know, somebody would be telling the story around the campfire if you were cavemen, or they would be drawing those cave pictures on the wall, but telling the stories, you know, so that was visual, but it wasn't reading. It was enhancing the told story. So,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah, really good point.
Yeah, I mean, books are great. I love books, but I think that's also kind of why I prefer an actual book to the Kindle. I'll read on the Kindle and that's fine, but I really would rather get the book in my hands. And that's because it's a tactile thing, I think, also.
Yeah. I fell in love with the Kindle because of the highlighting and things. You know, I prefer the Kindle at this point because I can just highlight a paragraph or whatever, and then it's just in the cloud, or, you know, and I can go get that whenever. But there is something. I still just love a shelf full of books. You know, well, when you go in there in a room and have a library, I still, nothing beats that. And being able to browse through books.
And just, and give books to somebody to read.
Yeah, that's true too. That's, you know, something you just else that's an it. Advantage.
Yeah, exactly. So there, I mean, both of them have advantages. So we've gotten way far off The Godfather, which
bounce.
I'm okay with that, by the way.
yes. Yeah.
So, but you listened to it unabridged. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I remember about the book, although we're supposed to talk about the movie, is, you know, of course there's a lot of violence in it.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the sex, but I imagine there's a lot of sex. That was the time for that kind of thing, especially that mm-hmm. kind of book.
Yeah.
That I find hard to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
That I'll kind of skip
over.
Well,
me too.
Over.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But you better say that. This is a Catholic podcast, man.
That is true. I don't remember anything gratuitous in the book, but that, it's been a long time.
Just that horse's head.
Yeah, just that horse's head. But what I do remember about the book is that, you know, have you seen Godfather Part 2? Probably not. You wouldn't have watched Part 2 without seeing Part 1. So Part 2, you know, if you remember the book, Part 2 is still in that book. Godfather 1 and 2 are that book.
Oh, okay, yeah, because so that's Robert, immigrant story, yeah, right?
Robert De Niro plays Don Corleone when he was young.
Tom and I were cracking up because... Mm-hmm. We were thinking about Godfather 2, and he said, well, I wonder who played Don Corleone. And I said, well, I saw the poster. Was it Al Pacino, or was it that guy who looks a lot like him? And he's like, I think it was that guy. Who is that? He looks, he goes, it was Robert De Niro. And
you know, I say Don Corleone, you know, Al Pacino still plays Michael, but Robert De Niro plays Vito as a young man.
Right.
Okay, that's, so in the book, remember, it goes through the whole thing about how he became who he was in the first place.
Okay, so I don't remember the book at all.
Yeah, so Godfather 2 has two stories going on. One with the Corleones now in Las Vegas, and the other half is Vito as a young man and how he became the Godfather in New York in the first place. It kind of just, you know, flits between the two stories, the whole movie.
Well, and I thought it was interesting that I think in both those movies, the screenplay was by Mario Puzo, if that's how you say it, and Francis Ford Coppola. So they wrote it together.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, pretty much everything in the book that I can recall, I don't remember listening to that book and thinking, you know, the movie didn't have this, or I didn't notice a big difference between the two. I really don't recall that. So,
well, it was, you know, it was long.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if they, I was like, I was thinking about it later and I thought, I don't know if they needed to put in all that stuff. Although there's a difference of opinion in our household. Rose, who we talked to about it, thought they could have skipped almost all of the part where Michael goes to Italy. And I disagreed with her. Mm-hmm. I thought that was important because it was one of the few humanizing moments that, you know, elements of his life. And, but I think they could have cut out a lot of the killings or something. I'm not really sure
why you say that. You know, I thought the script was pretty good myself.
Yeah.
Because
you thought they needed the whole 3 hours for everything.
I really did because I think that, like, for example, the very first scene opens with this guy sitting there talking to the Godfather. And he says, you know, we came to America and I had this problem with these people. And like a good American, I went to the police, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so he had a problem. His daughter was beat up by some idiot.
Oh, right.
So he's telling the Godfather this. And then the Godfather says, well, you know, you come to me on my daughter's wedding day and you want me to kill somebody. And that's very disrespectful and all this stuff. And
because he's never even said he was a friend of his.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Now
right.
You want something.
But my point is that guy comes back later.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, the script is such that stuff is all tied up. You know, it's interesting to see this guy here and then he comes back later. And then when you see him come back later, you know, it's like, oh, you know, now it's time to do this favor. I think that that was important to the script and the story.
Well, I'm not saying it wasn't. Okay. I'm saying that
I'm just wondering, you know, what exactly would you cut out?
I didn't watch a lot of the violence because, thank the Lord, it was telegraphed pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So when the guy thinks he's going to be clever and become a mole and he goes to the bar.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they know already. And at some point, you know, they suddenly they're holding his hand on the bar. And I'm like, ah, and I don't look away quite fast enough. So I saw a little bit of that. But then these noises went on forever. And I'm like, what are they doing? And Tom's like, oh, well, they're strangling. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, did they check with the medical experts to say it takes this long to strangle somebody? And I get it. I know, I realize I'm being picky because I know that they're trying to also show the extreme brutality and violence.
Yeah, but, and I think that was the point. I have no idea. I didn't do any research or anything. I have no idea what Francis Ford Coppola was trying to do. You know, I haven't read or seen any extras or anything like that. But my opinion of this movie is that it's about morality. And Don Corleone, Vito Corleone, walks around saying things. You know, there's this whole rule set that his family and these mob families work in that is this male thing that they've created, right?
Right.
And yet they constantly tell themselves that they're good. So Vito is like, you know, I think that they do. Vito thinks he's a good man. Vito is saying, you know, this drug business is no good, you know, but the prostitution and the gambling, you know, it's like he has this moral line, and we don't see the lives that are been ruined by him all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that he's doing, the crime family is ruining people's lives all the time. But what Francis Ford Coppola is showing us is the whole thing from their perspective. So we see the entire movie from inside their bubble, right? And mm-hmm. there's this whole moral code that is followed throughout the whole movie. There, you know, it's all about honor and all this other stuff. And, you know, murder is not the worst thing in their world, right?
No, that's
there are things
true.
That are worse than that. So it's just farther up the line. But that's what I got out of this thing is, and why I thought it would be interesting to talk about during Lent. Because we do that to ourselves a little bit. It's like, I don't know how many mini Corleone families I've met in the world. You know, when you're just saying that the thing that the most moral point I think that is made in this movie is that Vito and Michael are evil people. Okay?
Yes,
not,
they are.
Not even, I mean, even though they keep telling us that family is the most important thing, you know, and Vito says to that singer guy, do you see your family? You know, because if you don't see your family, you're not, you know, he's practically
you're not
saying
a man.
You're not a man. Right.
That was early on. A man who doesn't spend time with his family isn't mm-hmm. a real man.
Exactly. Like, right. Exactly.
That's
right.
That's interesting because you're not spending any time with your family right now. It's her wedding and you're blaming them, but you're allowing them to take you away from it while you display your power to everyone and
right.
dispense these favors.
Yeah. So Luca Brasi thing, you know, you're talking about him getting strangled and it is unpleasant to watch, right? So Luca Brasi gets killed by these guys, but that is the only reminder we get about who these people really are. We're seeing them and we feel for Michael. Maybe you didn't, but it's like he's creating empathy for these people that are despicable.
Well, yeah. Maybe.
And I think that's a really important point because it's just like, you know, you remember War of the Worlds, you know, talking about audio again.
Mm-hmm.
This leaps to mind. War of the Worlds by Orson Welles. Okay. It's like the whole point of that, you know, he scared people all over because of the way he did it. He did it as a news story on the radio. And people realize that, hey, you can't believe what you hear anymore. You can't, just because I hear something on the radio doesn't mean it's true anymore after that day. Right? So it's almost the same thing going on here. It's like, you know, you see these people as respectable people yet they are not.
Well, I guess, see, I never saw them as respectable ever. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think that they saw themselves as respectable except within the five families, you know? And yeah. I guess you're right. They mm-hmm. did think they were better than everybody, but I didn't get that from the movie because you only saw them within that context. What you did see within the family, because you were seeing the Corleone family the most, mm-hmm. or really exclusively, was you saw Don Corleone. He was in control. He had it put together. Now, by the end of the movie, he doesn't. And that's the point when I had to keep reminding myself, when he's running around playing with the little grandson, and he's more lovable because he's forgotten things. He's gotten older. He's failing. And I had to keep going, no, no, he's just as awful as Michael. That's yeah. how he got there in the first place. And so what you do see, as you're saying, is it's coming full circle. But what Michael does, you're right, Michael's character, especially when he's going to hide his father and then avenge what was done, and he's got to kill those two people.
Mm-hmm.
He is, at that point, he's showing us the most clearly, I think, what their lives are like compared to a normal human life, because he's terrified. He's going to do it. He's determined to do it because he knows the code and he feels it. He loves his father. And but you can see he's just almost not really able to do it. Mm-hmm. And but other than that, because they exist so entirely in their own world, I just felt like the whole thing was, you know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it was shot so dark, I think. And that's why those colors were so muted a lot of the time. I mean, that was the reflection of their world. It was very...
Yeah, everything's brown.
Brutal and dark. And,
yeah.
You know, they couldn't really see things clearly for what they were because the light never came into it. So I guess I didn't see how they saw themselves, except I guess when Don Corleone is at the meeting of the five families and he, you know, gives in. They kind of win. But just to be, I've kind of hinted at this, and so have you, because we exchanged emails earlier. But I didn't hate the movie,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't really like the movie either. It's one of the very few times when I've kind of felt like, eh, I can appreciate the artistic value of how it was made and the cast and the, you know, the editing and the cinematography and the, oh my gosh, Marlon Brando. Halfway through the movie, I was like, he deserved that Oscar. You know, he was so good. He was so subtle with a lot of what he did. Also, Robert Duvall, I loved his performance.
Yeah, Robert Duvall. Yeah, you mentioned that earlier. And
oh.
He did. He blew me away. His whole character reminded me of Lee from East of Eden. Isn't that that guy's name?
Yeah, the
The servant.
Cook? Yeah. Yeah, because he knows he's not really part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But he's accepted as part of the family. I mean, you know, he's the adopted brother.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But he's, but he never puts himself forward because he knows it's not in his blood, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's totally devoted to them.
Totally devoted and totally of service, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. But, you know, and the thing with, talk about artistry, the way they led into the famous horse's head shot, which I didn't watch at various moments because I was like, I can't tell what they're going to show. Probably mm-hmm. everything. I don't know. But the way it was sunrise and they're moving closer to the house and there's the pastoral music. And I'm like, no, no, no. Or just, you know, the hint of do, 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 do. And, oh, no, don't. The famous scene. And but at the same time, I was in awe of how well it was done.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of leads you in. And also the point that was being made with it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are all those things I can appreciate. But for me, the story was, well, you know, it got done. And I said, well, so what was the point? Michael started off trying to be a good person. He wound up as his father. Okay. Happens all the time.
I
didn't really care about how he got there because I didn't feel like you saw enough of what he was thinking to make it, to take me on that journey with him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I felt differently about that because that's the second.
Everybody does.
That's the second. Related. That's the second thing about the movie that I really liked. So the first thing is this moral relativism point.
Right.
It makes that point to me, the moral relativism point, which means, you know, moral relativism is not good.
Yeah, it's very bad.
It's very, very bad. The second thing was Michael's journey. And that scene that you talked about where he was in the hospital, and he noticed that there was nobody there guarding his dad.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I understand that I could be reading into this, but I empathize with that scene a lot because I could understand what Michael's spot was. So he's sitting here. He's the only competent son. His yeah. his older brother, well, he's got two older brothers, right? His right. oldest brother has an incredible temper and can be played like a flute, right?
Yeah.
And his other brother is a drunk and just incompetent. Fredo is his name. So the oldest one is Sonny and Fredo. So he's arrives at the hospital. Nobody's there. He realizes Sonny's incompetent, right? Whoever was there doesn't think enough of Sonny to stay, right?
No, the chief of police hauled them all down and arrested them.
Yeah, but the thing is, the chief of police was, you know, the Corleones don't normally have this problem. If Vito if Vito was in charge, that would never have happened. That's an assumption that I make, obviously.
Oh no, right? You're right, because basically the alpha was down, and so the other another family who kind of owned the chief of police moved in and said, it's our big chance.
Exactly. So Michael is presented at that moment with the decision, which he was creeping towards anyway, you know? And you never feel like...
Was he?
Well, I think so because...
I'm trying to remember.
First of all, I think Vito always knew that Michael was the one, right? Remember, you know, just at the beginning when he says, we're not taking this picture without Michael. He's waiting for Michael, you know? And Duval says to him, your dad's waiting for you. And there's obviously an implication there that there is a separation between Vito and Michael, as if there was an argument in the past or something. Again, I'm reading into this, but just the way that Duval said it, right? He says, you know, it was almost as if, you know, hey, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but your dad is in there waiting for you.
He's waiting for you. Right? Well, and at the end, though, he says, I thought you were going to be the one who was the senator or the governor.
Right. Exactly.
So he wasn't thinking he was going to step into his place. I think he really thought Sonny could do it.
Right. And that to me is the place that he was in. I don't know that he wanted to. But at the moment that he went into that hospital and realized Sonny can't do it. Okay. He knew that already, but now he's got incontrovertible evidence. I cannot leave now.
I don't think that was it, because I think he went into the hospital and said, holy crap, what am I going to do? I've got to do something right now, and I'm the only one here.
Yeah, but I honestly do, because he kneeled down to his dad and he said, I am with you now.
After he hid him.
After he
called
hit
Sonny
him,
the, first and said, there's nobody here.
Exactly.
And
Sonny
right
gets
off the
pissed.
And
said, you know, Sonny gets angry, and he's like, that's not going to help. You know,
yeah.
So, but that's me again, you know, I'm okay with you thinking I'm reading into this, but that's my reading of that scene is Michael makes the decision right there. He hides his dad. It tells his dad, I am now with you. Goes downstairs, tells that guy what to do, put your hand in your pocket or whatever. And then that
Baker.
Car drives by and they've saved his dad. The guy that's next to him is shaking like a leaf. He can't even light a match. And Michael lights it, and his hands are rock steady.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's the moment of change right there.
Now, well, he did make that commitment because he kissed his father's hand. And that's when his father started crying and had the smile on his face, because he knew what that meant.
He knew what that meant, right.
Yeah, because he kissed his hand like he was the godfather.
And he knew that his family was going to survive.
Or he knew that I just took it as, and maybe so, but... considering the dire circumstances and he was half alive and all this stuff, I felt that he knew his son loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to take care of whether it was just him or everything. But I just felt that was a moment of emotional connection for them both.
Yeah, I can't deny that either.
Yeah.
And again, there's an implication that maybe there was an argument and maybe that's why Michael joined the army. And maybe that's why he wasn't there, and that's, you know, all that stuff. And
that's why he dragged Diane Keaton into the picture. That was his moment of independence.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no, you're definitely right, because after that is when they're trying to figure out what they're going to do about the police chief and the head of the family who – the guy who wants to work the narcotics deals.
He wasn't the head of anything, but he was
working the deals.
And he's the one that, and this is the stuff that I love about this script. It was so subtle to me.
Mm-hmm.
The scene where this guy first meets Don Corleone, Vito, and Sonny is there, right? And all it took is for Sonny to say, "You mean to tell me that we can make..." And that was all he said. And then Vito looked at him, and then he sat back down. And then Vito completed saying no to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what the guy wanted, he wanted him to lend them the influence over the judges that they had in New York City so that they could be protected as they run drugs. And Vito, in his moral code, thinks that drugs are just no good. And... you know, there was a scene, you remember when all the families came together and mm-hmm. this one of the heads of the family says, "I don't want these drugs near schools." You know, that was a laugh out loud moment.
Right.
You know, because they're all telling themselves this stuff, we're making our own rules here. We're our own morality, and there is nobody outside of us that matters, you know? So, but anyway, that moment in the script, Sonny shows that he's a hothead to this guy. He also shows that he might possibly be talked to. He's someone that might be able to be reasoned with about drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That set the whole thing into motion. So now Vito, he's always saying, never say anything against the family in public. Well, you're thinking, well, that's a rule. That's an honor rule and all this stuff. But one other thing it is, he just gave this guy all the reason that he needed to kill Vito.
Right.
Right? Because he says, all right, if I kill Vito, I'm going to be dealing with Sonny. Sonny can be talked to about this. And that stuff, and another moment in the script that I loved was their sister gets a phone call one day from a woman, just a random woman who's looking for her husband. And they're already having arguments and problems. So she hangs up the phone, and that set into motion everything that needed to happen for the death of Sonny.
Which at the end, when Michael is questioning his brother-in-law, the sister's husband, about it, and he says, "That's all right. You can go to the airport. I just need to know, who did you give him up to?" And I had to stop. I have to say, I had to stop and think back, because I missed the significance of the woman saying whatever and him going along with it for the fact that he wasn't having an affair.
Right.
He just allowed her to get that upset so that she called Sonny and Sonny took off. Because at the point when he pulls into the very, very famous scene that practically everyone's seen where he pulls into the toll booth, I dropped a coin. I better get down on my hands and knees to get it. And Sonny's like, oh, no.
Yeah, he knew immediately.
Yeah, and that's it. He's done for. But I thought, how did they know he was going to be there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had missed that until at the very end when he's just, I just needed to know. And I'm like, it doesn't really matter what you do. You're a goner. So, you can believe him if you want because you're just that stupid. But
Right.
I was thinking... The whole time he's, smacking the wife in the face, the sister's husband would give her a black eye and all this. And Sonny, the hothead's going after him. And I'm like, you're married to the only daughter of Don Corleone. You're going to smack her around. What is wrong with you? You are an idiot.
Yeah. And he was doing it on purpose the whole time. That's what my opinion
is. I don't think the whole time. I think when he was hitting her, I think he was just, that was before then.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could be right. You could be right. After that time he got beat up in the street, that was probably his turning point, where he said, "All right, I'm going to go against the family now." Right?
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. But all these little intrigues and stuff, these little subtle things that happen in that, I really enjoyed that in the script. I also liked how the script, these people came back, like the guy at the mortuary and everything. And
oh yeah,
I thought it was a very good script that way. Really kind of tied and everything
the baker
up.
Being, you know, the baker, here's how you pay us back this way.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
I also liked the, I'm trying to think, well, just the parallels of what was happening in Michael's life with the big family events that were happening in the movie.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, there's the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
That's his kind of like, come on, you're going to come back. It's a new begin. You know, it's a beginning for the couple. It's a beginning for Michael. Are you going to be tempted into doing this? Towards the end, that couple's baby, it's the baptism.
Yeah.
And they're intercutting the baptism for a lot of reasons. But that's his baptism as the godfather of the family.
Yeah.
Baptism, full immersion, sort of, so to speak. And then at the end, you've got the funeral, and that's the full circle. The next generation takes over. And he, at that point, he seems like he's harder and more ruthless than his father ever was. But that's when I was sitting thinking about it, and I was going, well, you know, that's because we're comparing him to the established and then failing Don Corleone. You forget that he came from Sicily, where when Michael's in Sicily, he's like, where are all the men? He's like, oh, vendettas, there aren't any men. And it's like, see, this is what happens if you just let this keep going.
Yeah.
And so Don Corleone, that's when I was thinking about it, going, oh, well, he had to be like that to get into the position he was, where he's one of the five families. So he was probably just as bad as that. We just didn't see him getting his hands dirty and being ruthless that way.
I think you see that in number two, when you see the rise of Vito.
Right,
and, right. And probably parallel the heyday of Michael, because they moved to Vegas, and now that's the next stage of the family.
Yeah,
because at the end of this movie, obviously they take their revenge on everybody. And that was a pretty powerful scene to me, you know, with the baby being baptized and being intercut with all this, all the hits taking place because that he set into motion. And then they say, do you renounce the devil? And he says, I do. And you know that he doesn't. And to me, that cemented the whole morality issue. Because
he's lying right there while he's taking responsibility for the religious upbringing of an infant.
Yeah. And another thing, you know, with the women in the movie, which were practically non-existent, right? It was like they were all pushed out of this world. You aren't allowed in here. This is our stuff here. You can't come in. And he kept saying, you never talk to me about business. And that's the thing where he's trying to tell himself that he's good. He's like, in another way, he's admitting that he's not to himself, because he doesn't want this to cross into the family. Another point on that was when they went to the mattresses, right?
The mattresses.
All of the men, they said, that means that we're going to war. And when we go to the mattresses, we go to war, and we find this place, and we all live together where no one can find us. But they don't bring their families. They leave their wives and children in their houses. And nobody touches their wives and children. Right.
There's a code.
It's a code, right. So they're not even worried that the mob, or, you know, that their enemies are going to go kill their wives. They're not even concerned with that. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. It's and the women stay out because it's a lot easier to stay out. You don't want to know that. The one woman who does care, because she's an outsider, is Diane Keaton.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she, and I can't remember her name, right? Kay or something like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure
it
was Kay. Yeah.
But,
so he pretty much looked right at God and said, I renounce the devil, when you know he didn't.
Yeah, and he was embracing him.
And he looked right at Kay and said, I didn't do that, when he did.
Well, and he also looked right at Kay. I felt like if she doesn't know, she's like, I get it, Kay. You're lonely. You love him. But it's been a long time, right?
Yeah,
and she says, how long have you been back? And he says, a year. And I'm like, what? And now you show up saying, I love you and blah, blah, blah. Well, we know he lost his true love, Apollonia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He didn't think twice about Kay. He just took one look at Apollonia and was felled like an ox. So that's fine. But when he says, I've been back a year, but I love you and I miss you and I want to have children. And I'm like, oh, got it. Mm-hmm. You can't be the Godfather if you don't have the succession moving on, because it's like being a monarch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, you will just lie to her any old way.
Any old way, yep.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, for Tom and me, that baptismal scene was especially odd to watch, because just that morning we had been godparents to the child of a friend of ours, a couple that's a friend of ours. And it's funny because it's their seventh child.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom said, you know, some people you'd go, oh, we're the godchild to child number seven. I guess you finally worked your way around to us. He's like, but this couple, they are such good and faithful Catholics that, you know, the seventh set of godparents means just as much to them as the first one did. Oh, they really thought about it and, you know, put a lot of work into it. And we were watching that going, that's interesting, because it's the first time we've been godparents. And so we felt it was a huge honor. They obviously felt it was a huge honor. You know, you're asked all these questions about, are you going to take responsibility for this child's religious upbringing, you know, take a part in it and all this. So it's real important. And it's important to Michael, but somehow, because it's like, it's almost as if he feels like he can't be the family's godfather if he's not that child's godfather, because mm-hmm. he has to think about it. And then he says, yes, I'm going to be the godfather. And then he turns around and, you know, does everything. And I'm just like, I just thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'm not sure what the point is, but
no,
but either, that is but interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a position of honor.
Yeah, yeah. Or the fact that I guess his father was godfather to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that singer and various people. So
Right.
Yeah, I don't know what the point was, other than it did put him in the perfect spot to have that scene with the intercutting of the baptism and the murders and all that kind of thing. But mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, since I watched this movie again last week, you know, it's been kind of mulling it over. I listened to a podcast by a guy named Dan Carlin, and he talks about various things. I love Dan Carlin.
I do too.
But he was talking about a lot of different things, and you know, just thinking about this moral code and the whole, I think that it's a societal problem, and it's been from the first day of history, you know, the first time there was ever a group, you know, when you make decisions to protect the group rather than the correct decision,
mm-hmm.
it always ends up causing problems. Right. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, did you ever see Frost Nixon or even watch those Nixon tapes?
No, I always wanted to. I heard it was really good.
It's a really good movie, you know.
That's what I heard,
But, you know, so David Frost interviewed Richard Nixon after he had resigned, you know, so he's not president anymore. And he does this series of interviews. David Frost talked him into it. And and David Frost was on the line because he's this reporter. And, you know, if this ends up being a nothing interview, he's probably, you know, people are going to think he's Geraldo Rivera or something.
Right.
You know? But Nixon, you know, actually said this, you know, David Frost said something like, are you saying that the president can do illegal things? And Richard Nixon said, I'm saying that when the president does it, it's not illegal. And that was his, that was the moment that Frost was trying to get to.
Yeah.
And again, you know, Nixon was in this bubble. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if he was ever a really good man or not. I don't know that much about Richard Nixon, but he had clearly talked himself into that he was much bigger than any set of rules that there were. And, just kind of matches to me what this movie is saying. This is not a proper way to be.
Yeah. And the point that you made at the beginning, which is that, of course, it matters during Lent, but it matters anytime, is what are the places in our own lives where we are blind and we think we're entitled and we aren't?
Yeah.
You know, as Catholics or as just Christians, that's the dangerous place. Well, and it's just as people. I mean, the thing is that without religion, a lot of times you don't have the reason you don't have anything pushing you to ask yourself that question a lot of times until it's a little too late, just as a normal person.
Right.
You don't have to be embezzling or, you know, whatever. It can just be that you're not going to, you know, visit your aged mother as much as you should or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We do like to think more of ourselves because we look for reinforcement from all the people we're around.
Yeah, and we're hungry for bishops too that will not put the church above the correct decision. You know, they're worried about a reputation of the church that should never be a consideration.
Right, that was
never be a consideration. You know, so
when you look at a lot of the problems, when you look at historically the places where the church has gone wrong, that's not always the case, mm-hmm. but a lot of times it's the case.
Yeah, and it's a natural. I think that's why this movie resonates with so many people, is because this is almost a natural course of events. You know, we all know people that could remind us of the Godfather, you know, that they're the head of a company or they're ahead of something going on over here. They're ahead of this group or whatever. And they hold this power, you know, so it's almost like a microcosm of a country.
Well, but it also applies to your own family.
Absolutely, it does. I mean, and it applies to me.
Well, no, I didn't even mean your mm-hmm. family, Scott.
Yes,
not
my
mine.
Family. Alex, no. Come over here.
My family's perfect. No, but mm-hmm. what I was thinking of is this is the kind of thing that makes families and holidays so painful for a lot of people is there's one individual who, for whatever reason, feels entitled and they can't – somehow they've got power
mm-hmm.
and they can't be stopped. And whether it's they're running roughshod over everybody or they're just, you know, causing scenes or making things unpleasant some other way, pushing everyone's buttons, it's that same problem. It doesn't matter how big – you know, whether it's a country or a company or a family. And I guess it all starts in the family because that is the cornerstone of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholics especially have been told that lately, you know, lately meaning, I don't know, last 50, 100 years or whatever. But it's that thing of Adam and Eve, you know, they just thought they wanted to some extra knowledge so they could be more like God themselves with that tree. Well, thank you for nothing, everybody. You know, here we all are now.
Yep, yep.
So everything we do affects other people.
And that's
this true. Is, you're right, this is an extremely violent, an extreme way to show it.
Yeah, but effective, in my opinion. Effective for me, anyway.
Yeah,
You know, it's a movie that I watch now and then. I actually own these. I don't own a lot of movies, but I actually own this trilogy. I watch it every now and then. I even like number three. A lot of people don't like number three. Yeah. You know, one and two are pretty highly regarded. You know, they both won Best Picture and all that. And then number three was kind of forgotten. You know, Al Pacino was much older and things. But there's this one scene where he's confessing to, I can't recall if it's a bishop or something.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that's pretty high up in the church. So, you know, the church actually, I don't even recall the whole plot. It's been a while since I've watched it, but
yeah,
the scene where he confesses is, that's a good scene.
Does really. He really confess?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, you leave that up to you, but it was very emotional for him.
No, I was just curious. So
you bet.
Yeah. So he has to come face to face with his own humanity in
that
way.
Exactly. And, you know, the main thing that bothers him, you know, he's killed a lot of people, but in number two, well, you've read the book, you know, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but anyway, I'll just leave it at that. He did something in number two that does bother him.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can imagine.
Okay, well, I did a lot of things, but this was really bad.
Exactly. But that was a powerful scene for me. Anyway, that's one of the reasons why I like number three.
Rose had told us that, and I wasn't paying attention every time strictly. She had said that anytime you saw oranges, the next scene, somebody was going to be killed. I did notice a couple scenes where there were, like the scene with the five families. Bowls of fruit and oranges were always on top.
Yeah, yeah, and they were. The oranges were always there. And
Marlon Brando.
One of the times on this showing that I noticed it was, do you remember Abe Vigoda?
Yeah.
At the beginning, during the scene in the wedding. So Vito Corleone's daughter's getting married. He's there in the wedding. He's laughing, ha ha ha. Somebody tosses him an orange and he starts to peel it. And then he got his much later in the film.
Yes, but it was much
later.
I
think that that was kind of, you know, I have no idea why. I assume that he was just playing around, you know, Francis Ford Coppola.
That's what you wonder.
But, you know, I don't know what the symbolism would be or the purpose. I think it was just kind of funny.
Oranges, I just looked at it and went, oranges grow in Italy, I think, don't they?
Yeah, so, probably
I don't know. But anyway, because he's buying oranges when he's gunned down, Don Corleone is, and all the very, that was just kind of fun.
Yeah. Did you ever see The Freshman with Matthew Broderick?
No, that's another one that I always meant to watch.
Yeah, it's well, now that you've seen The Godfather, that's a fun one to see. It's got Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick in it.
And,
you know, he plays the Godfather, basically, the same role. And everybody's like, oh, my gosh, that must be the Godfather for real, you know. And Matthew Broderick is in some film classes. And the guy who he's taking this film class from just loves the Godfather. And he knows every word of it and everything. And it's a pretty good movie. I enjoyed that.
I remember hearing it was good when it came out. And I just, it's one of those, you know, you always mean to see it. Yeah, you just kind of forget.
It's not magnificent or anything, but it's a fun watch.
I won't blame you if I don't love it.
You bet. And
you're
then
safe.
Another one I think of that, you know, Godfather is just such a big part of culture, you know, pop culture.
Oh, yeah.
And
definitely.
You've Got Mail. Do you remember that one? Did you ever see that?
Try not to think about that one, actually.
Are you serious? You don't like You've Got Mail?
I'm sorry. I saw The Shop Around the Corner. I didn't need to see You've Got Mail.
Oh, I don't even know what that one is. But
Yeah. That's the problem.
But I just remember Tom Hanks, you know, and her having that moment where she's like, why do men like The Godfather anyway? And he's like, well, you know, blah, 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 whatever he said. So
I'll have to look it
so
up.
So anyway,
it's
tell me, what's The Shop Around the Corner?
Shop Around the Corner is from, gosh, is it the 1940s? I think it's Ernst Lubitsch. Oh, my gosh.
And well, that's really interesting.
He did To Be or Not to Be, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so it's...
Everything's connected.
Maureen Sullivan, maybe, and Jimmy Stewart, I think.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's this little shop, and she gets hired as the assistant salesperson, but she and Jimmy Stewart, who's like the hot shot sales guy... If I'm thinking of the right one.
So is it kind of a remake? Because I remember that the shop that Meg Ryan owned was called The Shop Around the Corner. And You've Got Mail.
Right.
And I had no idea that there was anything.
And they cannot stand each other. They're very competitive and all this kind of thing. And yet she's got a pen pal. And so they'll get these letters from each other, and he'll go, what are you reading? She's like, well, it's from somebody who's so sensitive, you wouldn't understand them. He's got poetry in his soul, and it's him, of course, you know. And so it's a really, it's a wonderful romantic comedy, and it's a real classic. And so they remade it into You've Got Mail.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it credited and everything?
Credited.
As in they said this is based on that movie or anything?
Oh, yeah.
That's great. How cool.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, and I tried watching it, but you know, there's something about Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks together that I just find them super boring. And I don't know why, because everybody loves Sleepless in Seattle, and I'm like, seriously?
Yeah.
I have not been able to get through it. I've tried twice. I don't know why I've tried twice, but I'm just like, oh my gosh.
Okay.
Just rent An Affair to Remember and watch that instead, because that's what that was made from.
And
kind
I haven't
of
seen that one either. I won't even know what that is.
Another classic that a couple who they meet on an ocean liner, and it's Irene Dunne and, gosh, I keep thinking Cary Grant, but I think it's like maybe Gary Cooper or somebody like that. But anyway, he takes her to meet his aunt in France or whatever, and they fall in love. And I think it's one of those things where – for some reason, some manufactured reason, like they're going to see if it's not just one of those shipboard romances, they're worried about that. So they agree that they'll meet again in a year and they'll meet at the top of the Empire State Building.
Ah,
well, okay. He's up there waiting for her.
Oh,
and she's walking, but she gets hit by a car. Yeah, and so she's in a wheelchair, but she's so proud.
I just seem to remember in Sleepless in Seattle, doesn't she get the idea to meet on the Empire State Building from a movie?
I think that's the only movie anybody's ever gotten that idea from, and it's because it's a great romantic movie.
Yeah.
Not a comedy, unfortunately, but it's one of those movies that when you see it and you just go, oh, this is so good.
Huh.
Oh, okay. And it's one of those I saw, you know, Saturday afternoon, Sunday night at the movie, you know, that kind of thing, when before there was any kind of DVR action going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those classic movies that, and I think it's not an exact remake, but I knew it was connected and I was willing for, that's okay. I don't mind. You know, they can do that.
Yeah.
I liked Pride and Prejudice, which was based on Pride and Prejudice, but Bollywood
that
style.
That one I have never seen.
Bollywood and Jane Austen. Come on.
So it's do you like Tom Hanks in anything, or
I love
Meg
Tom
Ryan
Hanks,
in anything? Just
but
them
him
together.
With Meg Ryan, I do not like.
I see.
I like Meg Ryan. Well, I didn't like When Harry Met Sally, but I just thought that was kind of stupid. But it was too forced or manufactured. But I do like Meg Ryan. She's perky and cute. That's her thing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of what else she's been in that I think I really do like her. It doesn't sound like it, I know. Now I'm going to have to look up movies she's been in and see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Yep.
But,
well, that's The Godfather.
Okay.
You bet.
Now I've seen it, and now I can say...
It's off your list.
if only it had been on my list.
If only it had been on your list. Well, now at least you know where the cliches come from.
That's right.
When you see a scene from a movie and you're like, oh...
That's right.
Somebody puts an orange in their mouth, you're like, ah.
That one Simpsons where the orange rolled across the floor, and as Marge is looking back and somebody's getting ready to kiss Homer's hand and Bart closes the door on her. I get it, man.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I remember somebody, you know, a long, long time ago when I was younger and not actively religious in any way, he said, you ought to read the Bible, Scott. And I said, oh, really? Why should I do that? He said, so you'll understand all the references in the movies and everything else.
Did you see that? There's that series on the History Channel called The Bible. It's a 10-part series, maybe?
Yeah. Tamahome gets a mention. Hi, Tam.
Tamahome,
he sent that to me and said, hey, check this out.
Okay,
and I was like, as I am with almost everything like this, I'm... Like, do I really want to watch that, or is it going to be some trashing of everything? I always assume that it's going to trash everything, so I usually don't watch. But what do you think it's going to be good?
Well, I don't know if it's good or not. I was offered – somebody from who was working to market it kept contacting me going, really, just watch the trailer and then promote it. And I'm like, no, I have to watch at least an episode. Oh, I don't have any screeners. And I'm thinking, what? Come on, it's the cost of a DVD, man, and some mail. This is nothing. They don't want to send that out to anybody. And it's just, she's like, but after it airs on the History Channel, I'm like, don't have cable. Sorry. But the thing is that I did read an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, or an op-ed thing, I guess, by Roma Downey, who was on Touched by an Angel, and Mark Barnett or Barrett, who is... These things don't necessarily endear them to me, but they tell me they've at least been in TV. He's worked on The Voice and Survivor. And they both were raised and educated in Europe. And so they said, you know, there, nobody wants to push religion in the classroom, but they teach the Bible as literature. And that's why we did this series, because there's so much of our literature that, as your friend said, or your acquaintance said, comes from the Bible. And they said, you know, the Supreme Court ruled in like 1968 or something that it was okay. We would like to encourage that. So we did this series about the great stories in the Bible to try to pique people's interest
Oh, that's cool.
To get them to pick it up and read it on their own and allow kids to just have it taught as literature class. And I thought, well, yeah, that's was the request I had on Forgotten Classics about reading Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Was let's discuss it as literature.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Well, I'll
so I don't know if the series is good, but that was the motivation. So that seemed worthy to me.
You bet. It is a good idea.
Yeah.
So I will hopefully they did a good job.
Yeah, I know. I haven't seen anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, me neither. Me neither.
Nope.
All right.
I will let you know if I do.
Sounds good. So what's coming up? Let's see.
Your book. Oh, yes. Octavia Butler.
Parable of the Sower.
That's it.
Yep. By Octavia Butler. I just read a short story by Octavia Butler over on Reading Envy.
Yeah.
You know, in that story thing I'm doing over there. And she is so good. Her short stories are marvelous, but she doesn't write a lot of short stories. In fact, in the introduction to this short story collection called Blood Child and Other Stories, she just mentions that she likes to work with ideas that take a while to develop. And she says, I rarely write short stories. She passed away not too long ago, unfortunately. But yeah, so she hasn't written a lot of short stories, but what she has written is just great.
Hmm.
The one I read was called Speech Sounds.
Like Ted Chiang or something?
Yeah, kind of, but she writes novels, you know, instead. She just doesn't write a lot of short stories, yeah.
I just meant her short stories.
Yeah, they're excellent.
That's all.
Yeah.
So, okay.
They're good.
Yeah. Well, and that's when I heard of her, is when she died and everybody started writing these obituaries. And I was like, I've never heard of this woman. Why is this? So,
yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. And then I've picked the next movie.
Oh, cool.
Which it may raise emotions just the same as The Godfather did. I don't know. This is called Be Kind, Rewind.
Okay.
Directed by Michelle Gondry. Who's French.
Excellent.
Starring Jack Black, Jack Black, Mos Def, and Danny Glover. So put that together. Wrap your head around that one.
Well, all right. That's cool.
And I'm going to say, and I'll say it again, but the first half is not like the second half.
Okay.
The first half was more Jack Black-ish and, you know, but all these movie critics loved it when it came out. I was so interested in And it's actually really a good movie. So.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Okay. And we're still, we're reading Jesus of Nazareth. We'll just mention that.
The
show on that is going to be on May 16th. I'm looking at the schedule here. Okay. So, anyway, it's a good, it's nice to read slow and take a while with it. So if you want to join us on that one, that's on May 16th.
Yes, I've been now pestering my husband. I was like, you know, if I read a chapter a week, it'll be easy. And I am, except I'm doing things like going, Tom, listen to this. I'm just going to read you two pages.
Mm.
And he's like, oh, good. Glad it's a small book. Small pages.
You bet. That's great. All right.
Then before that, though, we'll be watching Of Gods and Men.
That's right. Of Gods and Men on May the 2nd.
Yeah.
Yep. And then your book is to be announced on April the 18th.
I know.
Yep.
I know.
That's great.
Still thinking about that.
All right.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Julie. Thanks for watching that film.
Oh, no. Thank you for getting me to watch it.
You bet.
Because it was, like I say, there were a lot of things that I thought were really good about it. And now I've seen it.
Good.
That cultural icon.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah.
And have a good couple of weeks.
We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.